And welcome to WGXE 90.7 FM, Acre Catskill Hudson, hands-on community radio for Greene and Columbia County. I'm Ron Diamonstein, and I'm privileged to be joined by Lauren Groff, the author of a new novel recently published from Voice Hyperion, Arcadia. Welcome, Lauren.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Oh, it's a privilege, actually. So this is your second novel, roughly put, Arcadia utilizes the life of Bit, whose given name is Ridley Stone, to chart the cycle of existence of a utopian commune called Arcadia from its founding in the autumnal haze of the 1960s through the growing pains and fissuring of the 70s and 80s and the lingering aftermaths leading into present days and beyond. What attracted you specifically to depicting communal life?
Well, you know, all of my work comes from someplace very urgent. This book was born when I was pregnant with my son. I was new to Florida, where I live. And Florida is very different from upstate New York, where I'm from. And I didn't know anybody here. And I'm not used to a place where I can't just walk everywhere. And it's also brutally hot, starting from about March through about November. So I just, I was longing for community. I was longing for a group of people to join in and help me through this pregnancy. That was actually very difficult for me. And I was also really very unhappy. And I tried to think about how to change what was going on with my life. And I had this I write about things that I want to have happen, and I wanted to have a community around myself. And so I started looking into intentional communities and utopias and things like that. So that's really the nugget of where the book came from.
Yeah, so communal life is generally thought of as something like repersonalizing society, I guess, emphasizing person-to-person relationships. And that seems to definitely be a strong theme that runs through the book. The interior world of Bit, I guess we should just call him Bit, since you do, seems to be reflective of the changes in the world outside. Specifically his identification of himself, and I mean his self, with the commune. And this just goes running through from his childhood, adolescence, into his adulthood. There's a particular line, actually, where he's writing. You write that there is a puncture in the world, and everything Bit knew about himself is escaping. And you know, the general idea of an Arcadia, I think we should also kind of bring this up in the context of the classical world, is generally thought of as being a lost world of harmony and bliss, you know, in the context of some sort of apparent contrast, maybe to a utopia. I mean, it's a more related to specifically an environmental context. And I'm trying to see how all of this kind of fits into this group of people who sort of park their buses on this abandoned sort of landscape in upstate New York and declare this to be their home.
Right. Well, to begin with, you know, Sir Thomas More wrote Utopia, and that's where the word came from, his Utopia. And in Greek, it's sort of a portmanteau word that comes from two different meanings. So there's utopos and utopos. And one means no place, and the other one means best place. So a utopia is no place, but it's also the best place, because a best place cannot actually exist in the actual real world that we live in. That doesn't mean that we can't try to make it happen, and that there isn't so much beauty involved in working at the best of our abilities and being the best people that we possibly can be. And so Bit's reflection of the world, I think inherently he and everybody else who is a part of Arcadia understands that creating a perfect world is not necessarily something that's achievable.
But the struggle is worth doing. I mean, it's actually paramount to do so. Yes, imperative.
Right, and you know what annoys me is I guess a lot of times you hear about utopianists, and you hear people say, oh, they're just romantics, you know, they don't understand, they're naive. When the reality is, if you actually look at a lot of communal living from the past three centuries of American life, people did understand what was going on. A lot of people were incredibly well educated. They understood what could be possible and what could not be possible. And they decided to do it anyway. You know, it's not that they were romantic or naive. There has to be a certain amount of faith in humanity in order to do this, but that doesn't mean that there's naivety involved. I felt like defending these people who wanted to go out and make something beautiful of the world, you know, even if they know that, you know, the chances are it's not going to work out. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so loss does seem to be the predominant theme that runs through the book. Many other reviewers that I've read of the work have pointed this out. And I suppose, obviously, that would be a given in a book called Arcadia, since it's always this pining for the lost world. But, of course, loss seems to be considered, at least in as I was reading it, an essential and, I guess, I don't know, an organic sense of rebirth. I mean, because if you think about it, your book begins with his pre-birth memory and the death of the older gentleman, the artful codger, or the dartful codger. Is that what
the
you
dartful
were?
Codger.
The dartful codger, yes. And then it ends with the death. I'm not going to do too much of a spoiler, but it ends with the death and then apparently some kind of rebirth. So there is definitely cyclical. At least,
well, that's, yes, exactly. But that's human lives. I mean, every single individual human life goes through these cycles where we lose what we think is the closest thing to our hearts. I mean, we lose our childhoods. We lose our parents at a certain point. Yeah, we hope we don't lose our children, but sometimes that happens, and that's terrifying. So an individual human life is utopian in a way because we wake up every morning and try again. You know, but also I think that the communal human aspect of the world is in its own way also utopian. You know, we create these governments and we create these communities that we live in, the small towns like Catskill, you know, like Cooperstown where I'm from, and you involve yourself to a certain point in the lives of your neighbors, and you see the towns go through phases of stasis, but then incredible growth, and then, you know, periods of lesser activity. And I think it's just human nature to go through these bursts and these periods of withdrawal and retraction. And I think it's incredibly beautiful, too. I also think that you can't appreciate the moments that are incredibly beautiful, I can't, without these moments where you sit back and you think about the world. And even as a creative person, I can't write every single day. I mean, I wish I really could. And there's a few people in the world who can. Stephen King writes every single day. But after a book comes out, I have to take a break and sit back and read, you know, 8 books a week and just and regrow, you know, that whatever part of me that's creative. So I think that just the creative human endeavor is incredibly cyclical. It goes like that. Yeah.
Just a reminder, you're listening to WGXE 90.7 FM. I'm Ron Diamonstein, and I'm talking with Lauren Groff about her recently published novel, Arcadia. Let's talk a little bit about the role of place, actually, since we were just kind of circling around it. A little bit about your background, perhaps, in Cooperstown, which was the source of so much for your earlier novel, The Monsters of Templeton. And specifically, a little bit also about the role of communal life up in Oneida, which I think must have been a source, a reference source for you. It seems that there's a certain kind of magic here in upstate New York. And perhaps you'd like to like
sure.
Touch a little bit about that.
Oh, I feel like it is a magical place. I think partially it's because I left for good at about 17, you know, when people graduate from high school. And I was born in Cooperstown. I was raised in Cooperstown. And in a sense, it was a kind of an idyllic childhood. You know, we have that stunning lake, and I was lifeguard there all throughout the summers, and, you know, we swam and we played, and I read lots of books, and it's not as if there wasn't worry, because I think in any childhood there's darkness any childhood, but it was a beautiful place. And when I search for a setting for my books that reflects a feeling of nostalgia, a feeling of something that I've lost, I think I possibly go back to upstate New York a lot. And you're right, Oneida, thank you for saying that, because Oneida really was an incredible impulse behind this book. I actually went to visit Oneida when I was vastly pregnant, enormously pregnant. And I don't know if you know, you can actually stay in Mansion House.
Yes, it survives. Yes.
Yeah. It's so cool. It's a bed and breakfast. Well, part of it has retired people in it. And then another wing of it is just a guest house. And it's an amazing thing to stay up there and to look at the museum and to look at all the vitrines of all of the amazing things that the Oneidans did and to read about them. And you know, I think that they were extraordinarily successful for a very long time. They had some things that didn't work out right. You know, yes. The eugenics experiment was really creepy and shouldn't have happened, but it did. And that's sort of what is punctured the souffle, you know, that made everything fall flat. But it was, you know, the landscape up there is almost Grimm's like, you know, Brothers Grimm. And that's another element of the book that it felt necessary, you know, the sort of fairy tales, but the dark fairy tales, the spiky fairy tales, and that was really important. And so the landscape actually spoke to the feeling of vestigial forests and the darkness, and possibly, you know, you look up and there's a little girl walking around and past you in a little red cloak. You know, if everything feels possible and magic feels possible there.
I couldn't help but think about the idea of ritual magic as kind of tied into the ceremony of the legends and myths of the land. Because this kind of harkens back from the retelling of tales by Fenimore Cooper, obviously, or Washington Irving, or trying to, kind of bring together the old and the new. And even if you think about the siren call of the big city, downriver, New York, I mean, because you do that here, obviously, Bit goes down eventually to the city when his family needs to get away from the collapsing commune. It's actually kind of, I couldn't help but also give a little bit of a thought to Chinua Achebe's
Things Fall Apart.
Yes, because there's a slight connection there. I mean, he is mentioned many times, I think, in interviews that it has been thought of as there's an element of Greek tragedy about that. But he has often said that the ceremony ritual that tie people to the land is of absolutely crucial importance to his people. If you have, in your case, in Arcadia, people who are trying desperately to get back to the land for any number of personal reasons. Obviously, there's going to be this connection in Bit, especially. I wanted to actually then, lead into a very specific question. Bit's choice of silence during his early childhood as part of a magical bargain, he seems to make. So,
yes. Yeah. Well, don't we all, I still make those bargains. And I don't know who I'm making them with and whether or not, I don't know. But I think it's possibly a part of human experience, and especially as a child. And I can still remember a lot of those moments where I felt it was absolutely urgent to make a bargain with the world, with my conception of God, in order to make sure something happened. And whether or not it's, you know, okay, if I leave the sheet over my head, the monsters won't get me. And I remember that very much.
Yes.
Or, you know, if I'm good for the next 2 weeks, you know, and I make this bargain that I won't, you know, punch my brother in the face, then maybe I'll get something, you know. And it's just, it's a part of the way that we invest our actions with a larger, more mythical overtone, I think. But bit, what's happening in that first part is his mother is incredibly sad. She's a very sad person. And he looks at her, and nothing he does can pull her out of this sadness. So he makes this bargain with her. And he's partially led by the Grimm's fairy tales, because in fairy tales, people make bargains all the time, you know, and they say, all right, well, I get this acorn, and if I can take this acorn over the magic mountains, you know, I get the princess. Yeah, so it's fairy tale logic in a way that makes a total sense to a little boy, a very little boy. If he doesn't speak, his mom will come back to him. And I can think of nothing more necessary when you're a child than to have your mother who's here, and it feels like every day she's leaving you and into her sadness to come back to you. It felt real and necessary that he made that bargain.
Yes, and we should emphasize, I think, that Bit is very, very tiny.
First part, yes. He's
tiny throughout the... I mean, he's a pretty short guy. That's the impression I get.
Yes, he is. He's a very small man. And he grows into a very, very small man. And that gives him the ability to stay unseen and to be the observer in a large part. I mean, he's a very watchful human being.
Yes.
And he's very pensive. And his smallness allows him to be that way.
Yeah, it's an interesting paradox, perhaps, that for someone who is basically essentially silent for the first, 9 or 10 years of his life, at least were the first series of chapters, that his language in terms of how you have constructed him with this sort of third person, you know, narrative structure, he is particularly observant. I mean, there's a lot of observation. I mean, I guess.
Wait, yes. The language is the third person narration, and I try to draft in the first person, but it's very, very hard to make a 5-year-old speak in observation. I mean, they observe things, I think, in strobe light ways. They can see beauty. You know, little children can see. When a stream is rolling and the sound that it makes over the rocks, but I don't think necessarily they can always put it into words to make that clear to a reader. So the third person felt also necessary when I went back to rewrite the book.
It's interesting you use the word strobe a light, because I was going to ask you in terms of if we touch on some of the more practical aspects of your writing, but there is, I've noticed this almost a staccato jump cut method of moving through narrative time that you use. It's almost as if, yes, that's another way of putting it, it's a strobe light. First they're kind of, you close your eyes and people are here, then they're over there and they just keep on, you know. I'm just gesticulating for our listeners out there. I'm just gesticulating.
Yeah, well, I wanted a lot of the work to be done in the reader's head also. And I also think that's possibly the way that I and maybe other people think of our lives. Not necessarily as a smooth stream, but as a series of very vivid scenes and impressions. That's the way that I remember things. I don't know about you. What do you think?
I think that some people who read the book, some reviewers, were kind of hesitant to fully embrace this element. And I, on the other hand, found it immediately engaging. I mean, I am not just shining you on at all. It was an element of the book that allowed me to more readily kind of fall into. But then I've always often been very susceptible to a certain kind of magical realism, quote unquote, you know, to a certain degree. You know, I'm a great admirer of Garcia Marquez, obviously.
Yes. And
then in terms of film itself, I mean, Godard is a favorite filmmaker of mine. So, you know, the idea of the jump cut. But yeah, I thought that was a very interesting attempt, and I thought it was rather successful in terms of trying to capture the passage of time as it would be perhaps seen by a young person.
Well, I also wonder if we don't impose clearer narrative structure in retrospect as opposed to at the moment. I think at the moment there are times that feel more lived than other times. And in retrospect, possibly we smooth it over into a clear fabric. When at the moment, possibly, you know, just in my day alone, you know, I can be with my kids for 8 hours and I can't remember a single thing that happened, right? But then, you know, I get a telephone call and it's suddenly, boom, I'm present in the moment. And not to say that I find my children boring, but, you know, a day with a one-year-old and a three-year-old is a long day.
Yeah. Well, we'll touch on some aspects of that in a moment. Again, a reminder, you're listening to 90.7 FM, WGXE. I'm Ron Diamonstein, and we're having a conversation with Lauren Groff about her recently published novel, Arcadia, available from Voice Hyperion. Maybe now would be a good time. If you'd like to read a little selection from the book, we had pre-selected a couple of paragraphs dealing with sort of the origin story of Arcadia, as told to Bit by his dad, Abe.
Right. So Abe here is speaking to Bit. He's a Bit is about 5 years old, and he's sleepless one night. So, "You were born on the caravan," Abe says softly, "when we were a bunch of groupies following Handy around for spiritual food, 24 max, going to the concerts, staying for the meetings after. Everywhere we went, we saw communes, some that worked, others that didn't. Yurts and geodesic domes and sweat lodges and squatted in mansions in the inner cities, and we started having an idea that even though everyone else was doing something along these lines, what we wanted to do was unusual, pure. Live with the land, not on it. Live outside the evil of commerce and make our own lives from scratch. Let our love be a beacon to light up the world. Anyways, those days, Handy was the only one with any medical training from being a medic in Korea, and he thought that Hannah was 5 months along because she wasn't huge. So here we are, driving through the mountains, trying to get from Oregon to Boulder when a sudden snowstorm comes up, flakes huge as plates on the windshield, and wouldn't you know it, Hannah chooses this time to pop. We were in that little Volkswagen camper the motor pool uses for trips into town. I'd fitted it out with a stove and all, pretty nifty, but we were in one of the smaller vehicles, so we were stuck at the back of the line in those narrow mountain passes. I knew I had to get up to where Handy was, because I sure as hell didn't know how to deliver any baby, undercooked or not. So up we go, fart-licking past everyone in the left lane, and we'd all be dead if anyone came the opposite direction. Finally, we pass the Pink Piper, and I slow the whole zoo down. Turn at a sign that says, Ridley, Wyoming, population 5,000-something. And I think there's got to be a hospital there, but there's snow on the sign, and of course I turned the wrong way. On and on and on, mile after mile, and it's blackout. And finally we see lights and stop, and the caravan folds itself around us and the Pink Piper to keep out the wind, and the door opens, and some snowy person bursts in. I was expecting Handy, but who was it? Astrid. Is that good, or should I keep going?
Well, you could keep going, but then then where would we end up if another couple of hundred pages?
Right.
That's the audiobook version. It's presented by WGXE. Astrid, just to mention, is Handy is the sort of leader. He's the Pied Piper, as it were, a musician who people have gathered around, sort of a very charismatic figure. Astrid is his wife, who functions as a nursemaid and a midwife. Hannah is Abe's wife, Bit's mom. So I think I just wanted to kind of draw this to a close with just touching a little bit on your the aspects of your writing, you having two young children. Let's begin here. How difficult is it now, perhaps, to find time to write? I mean, are you running into some obstacles, as it were?
You know, I owe previous generations of female writers a huge amount, because what I learned is that you have to be absolutely fierce and ferocious with your time. And I would far prefer to be with my babies all day long, but I also want to be happy for them, you know? And so there's a big balance, and I have to, you know, I have wonderful babysitters. That's the beauty of a college town. You have these brilliant people who come in and take care of your children for you. So I'm just extremely fierce and dedicated to only two things on this planet, and three things, two children and my work. And that's it. I don't really have a life outside of that. And that's fine for now until they get out of the house, and then I can slowly get my life back again. But for now, you just have to close the door and hope that everything's going to go well while you're inside.
You've worked in a short fiction format before. You've published a collection of short fiction as well. So I mean, you can go back and forth. You're comfortable moving between the long form and the short form.
Well, they're very different. It's almost as if, you know, short fiction is closer to poetry than to a novel anyway. So, yeah, no, I love both forms. I probably prefer writing short stories just because they're so... When you have to write one, you have to write it, and you can't do anything else. And I love that feeling of just intensity.
And I understand that you tend to develop ideas and prose through multiples of drafts, so you write a lot. I mean, and that's also why I kind of brought the personal into this, because I wondered how that impacted. I mean, your particular style of writing, where you would write a long draft and maybe, you know, put it aside and write another and give it to to some trusted readers and write again and write again and just work it and work it and work it. And I don't know if one can discuss that.
Sure. I write in longhand for the first
really? So not, four drafts too. No computer.
Yeah. No. Well, you know, when it's in type, it feels almost set in stone. And what you want for the first few drafts is to be divorced from the prose itself, because the prose for me, you know, as a writer, does not matter until you get the structure solid. You get what exactly the story is and who these characters are. And I think a lot of times I get, if I write directly onto the computer, I get caught up in the words, and I can spend, you know, 3 weeks on one sentence. Hmm. And that's just not helpful until you get to the point where that's okay. I write lots and lots of pages for a single 25-page story, I'll probably write 300 pages and throw them all out until the final draft. So, yeah.
Wow. I mean, yeah, that's a lot of effort, I have to say. You just mentioned that one of the benefits of living in a college town, Gainesville, University of Florida, I'm assuming, yes, if I'm,
yes,
yeah,
yes.
Is that there's a certain degree of like-minded individuals who are, you've kind of found yourself a little, something akin to a commune, haven't you, in a sense?
No, well, you know, I've been here for 6 years.
Or community.
Sort of. And I've just started to find my community. And I think if you work alone in a dark office for 10 hours a day, it's going to be hard to find a community no matter what you do and no matter where you are.
Lauren Groff, the book is Arcadia, published by Voice Hyperion, and it's strongly recommended. I thank you so much for joining us here in WGXC.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.